NetBox Labs helps companies build and manage complex networks. The company's NetBox Cloud product offers an enterprise-grade SaaS version of open-source NetBox, the world's most popular network source of truth. Check out their educational network management webinars or join a NetBox meetup at netboxlabs.com/events. That's netboxlabs.com/events.
Hello, and welcome to the Network Automation Nerds podcast, where we explore the latest in network automation from a practitioner's perspective. I'm your host, Eric Cho, a network engineer who loves everything about network automation.
Network Automation Nerds podcast.
Today on the show, we have a very special treat for our audience of tech enthusiasts and network professionals. In this dynamic landscape of network automation, where innovation is the name of the game, our guest today stands as a beacon of brilliance, carving out paths that many did not know was possible. And I meant every word of it. So today we have with us Roman Doden, the mastermind behind Container Labs, an initiative that has been nothing short of revolution in the realm of network automation. And as someone who has worn many hats, developer, network engineer, advocate, Roman has been a knack of simplifying complex processes and introducing efficiencies where they're needed the most. I am super excited to be talking to you, Roman, and let's get the show rolling. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me, and what an introduction.
It's all right. It's a ChatGPT come up with it.
Definitely.
Before we get started, I usually start with, you know, kind of your origin story. So Roman, can you tell us a little bit about how you got into technology, what led you into network engineering, and led you to this whole path down of Container Lab?
Yeah, I think I need to rewind back to, 1996. That's where
1996. I remember that time. Yeah. The Bulls won the NBA championship. I remember that time, see?
Oh, okay. So you associated with that. So for me, 1996 was the year when I got introduced to a personal computer, right? So I had a friend and he got his first, I think it was 386 personal computer. And he was the only one in my environment who got one. So of course, he was like the magnet to a lot of boys of my age. And he was like twice as old as me, right? And
yeah.
I hang out with him almost, like every other day. And first, of course, we, as the boys do, we start to play games like Wolfenstein, Dooms, and all the golden classics of the personal computing games.
Right.
And then it lasted for a couple of probably months, maybe like a year. And then my friend started to dive into programming. So he started with Fortran and then he started with Delphi. And I was looking at what he's doing and I was like saying, wow, this is cool. Like you can make computers do what you want. And I started to explore Delphi myself. That was my first programming language, which is, I consider, quite unusual choice. Back then it was like the only choice that I had because my friend started doing that and he was like my teacher.
Right.
So that's how he got me into computer stuff. And you know, like when you start with computer games, you always kind of upgrade your PC, you solder some CPUs, you do some memory upgrades, you play with video cards and all of that. So that gets you some hardware skills as well. And then you mix on top some programming languages, and you are almost like a ready-made computer engineer. So that's how I started, as funny as it gets.
That was back when, I mean, I imagine this was like a tower PC, right? So it wasn't like a laptop. That was when you could actually swap out memories or hard drives. Or I mean, I was pretty bummed out when Apple came out with like the unibody design where you can't replace your memories anymore. Because that's what I used to do, was just like get it and then swap out whatever I needed, right? More memories, more hard drive disk space or whatever. But
exactly. Yeah. It was a tower PC and you had like one of the walls dismounted because it was running too hot and you needed some fresh air. So yeah, it was fun times. And then you started to play games like Doom over 56K modems, over PSTN, you know.
That is when your mom was like, hey, get off the internet. I need to use the phone.
That's my life, man. So that's how it started. And yeah, eventually through gaming and first programming languages, it all started for me like that. And then I just started to dive more into all of that. And it continued to lead me to engineering background and technology. But then I didn't get any networking engineers until quite recently when I started to work for Alcatel-Lucent back in 2015. So that's that's the time that I first started to do like real network engineering. Before that, I was doing some different kind of jobs, but not network engineering related, still kind of technical, but not in the field of network engineering.
Did you study computers in a uni?
Kind of similar technology. So I was, my master's degree was in fiber optic networks.
Oh, okay.
But it's fiber optics. So it's,
yeah,
not
it's like layer
necessarily,
one.
Yeah, that's more like physics and all that stuff.
Exactly.
So I didn't get any, you know, CCNA kind of material
yeah.
before my career at Alcatel-Lucent. That's quite recent, to be honest. I wouldn't consider myself to be a network engineer still, although like it's been, what, 8 years now, but I know a lot of colleagues who are way more advanced in network engineering than myself. So I'm kind of balancing between network engineering and software engineering, and I'm rather good in both. So that's my life.
I think you're being too humble. I think you're good at both. And that is why you came out with like, you know, Container Lab. You're able to code and you're able to kind of communicate with both network engineers and software developers, right? How did you learn coding? Like, did you take classes? And you mentioned you got your introduction in Delphi, but what led you into more coding?
Like, truth be told, I didn't have any classes in software engineering or computer science. At my uni, we didn't have a single C programming class or a course. We only had assembly, weird, right? Assembly and then MATLAB. These are the two courses that were involved, were surrounded by computer science topics. But I never had like a high-level programming course in my life. So all I did was self-studying and just poking around, you know, typing on my keyboard until stuff gets to work. And that is probably the regret that I have. So I would really love to study computer science like properly with all the background and founding layers of this complex topic, but I never did. And that's probably why I cannot consider myself a software engineer, because I really lack this low-level understanding how computers work. But yeah, through self-studying, I got the necessary skills to be able to automate networks and to build some not so complicated projects and products. So that's how I started, and that's what still keeps me going, to be honest.
That's actually really amazing on that self-study part, right? Because considering the accomplishment and the progress you've made, and you're essentially self-taught. So we got to, maybe not today's session, but like we got to separate in the session and just tell us how you learn, right? Like, I'm sure you have to stay disciplined and deliberate practice and all the other things that we've talked about with other guests that is really hard to do. And you were able to be self-taught.
Yeah, that's something that one needs to have. If you cannot just sit and do stuff and accomplish the goal, be it a software project or, you know, some chores that you need to do, it's hard to make yourself do that and kind of get to the end of the road and see the light at the end of the tunnel. In my case, when I self-studied, it was always about the hands-on projects.
Right.
So I never really took a book and get from one cover to the end.
Mm-hmm.
It was always like, here is a problem I want to solve. How do I solve it? And then you go to Stack Overflows or now ChatGPT or what have you.
Right.
And then you try to apply whatever you have like next to you or maybe like some colleagues that can help you out with. You absorb all this knowledge around you and you start to do that. And of course, it doesn't work from the get-go. It never works from the first time. So you have to accomplish or embrace the failures and continue going. And I think important part is just not to leave it aside from the first failure. Just take it as it is. Try to refresh. If it doesn't work from the first try, like take a moment. You know,
or the first 10.
Yeah, the first 10. Take a moment, take 10 moments, and then go back and try again. And sometimes it helps. Just like slip over it, approach the same bug or the same problem that you would like to solve. And that how it clicked for me. And I still apply this principle to this day.
That's amazing. I just finished reading the book Amazon Unbound. And in the book, it always talks about Amazon's coming down from Bezos is working backwards. Even before they launch any product, or even if they talk about launching a product, they have to write like a press release on how the product benefits, or like a press release on, you know, what are the features of the product, how the product benefits the end user. And from there, they work backwards into the beginning. And they, you know, look at the press release day, maybe like 6 months from now. And so where do we have to be in order to meet that deadline? And that goes back to what you were talking about, right? You start from the end and then work backwards. So you already know your outcome. You want a container-based network lab. And what actions and what skills do I need to acquire in order to achieve that?
Yeah, more or less like that. Sometimes you don't even know what you want to do. You have like a far-fetching goal that, yeah, I want to build something that helps me do X, Y, and Z. But then when you start to work on that, you immediately realize that, yeah, besides X, Y, and Z, you also want to do A, B, C, D, and F. And then your requirement set is growing, and then you start to deliver more pieces that you initially intended to. So it's all like kind of fluid and flexible. It's never that easy to say, yeah, here is my goal, and I will reach it in 2 days.
Yeah.
At least for me, you know, it's never like that. Here is my goal, and then I reach it in X days. And yeah. X is a variable.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly an iterative process, but it doesn't change the fact that you're outcome-driven. It's always like the benefit that you're delivering versus like, oh, wow, you know, this I could be so much more efficient writing this, but I totally get what you're saying. You're iterative, you embrace your failure, you learn during the process. So you talked about you're self-taught, you're studying your master's degree in fiber optics, and you didn't get into network engineering until Alcatel-Lucent that you got.
Alcatel-Lucent. I will start with a fun story how I got into Alcatel-Lucent.
Oh, yes, please.
That's a fun story. So when I was sitting back in St. Petersburg, where I originally from, and I decided to change my previous job, I was like looking at the market and where can I go. And my previous job was like totally unrelated to networking, maybe like 10% of coverage or similar job requirements.
Yeah.
And then I saw this Alcatel-Lucent opening, and it was NPI role. And NPI stands for New Product Introduction for Networking. So basically, it's a person who needs to introduce new networking technologies to customers and be like, you know, it's not a consultant engineer, but still be like very much technical.
Yeah. Job in the US, some people would call that like success engineer or like an advocate for sure. But
oh, yeah, it's a fancy title. No, in my case, it was not like that. So the title still presumes that you work with a console and you help to configure stuff and you do demos, et cetera, et cetera. But no, the fact was that the job description had all the fancy words like BGP, RCPT, MPLS, ISIS. So all the service provider technologies that Alcatel-Lucent was strong with.
Right.
And out of this list, like let's imagine there's 10 technologies. I knew zero, like literally zero. And then I look like BGP, well, by that time I had CCNA. And in CCNA, they don't touch on service provider at all.
No.
Right? They don't teach you RCPT and traffic engineering and MPLS technologies.
Right.
So I only knew BGP, but I knew it from CCNA material at the length and depth of CCNA. And that was definitely not enough. So I was studying for 2 days. I took a book about BGP, and I think I took TCP/IP volume 2. Mm-hmm. And I kind of locked up myself in the room and I started to read it. And of course, like, yeah, I failed to remember most of it, but I remembered core pieces like path selection, you know, autonomous systems.
Sure.
Something like very core and conceptual. Sure. And then I go to the interview, and the guy who was interviewing me was one of the smartest engineers in Alcatel-Lucent St. Petersburg branch. And he roasted me well. So he destroyed me. You know? He asked me questions I had no idea about. And after 15 minutes, he, like the boss asked this interviewer, like, what do you think about Roman? Will he continue with us? And the guy like shook his head like, no, not really. It's totally off. And I was like,
wait,
yeah.
Yeah, like, okay. No, it's just, like, please go on.
Yeah, time to pack my bags and go back. But then they came back saying like, you know, let's give it a try. Come join us and we'll see how it goes. Like, you're definitely fresh, but we see that there is some potential, or I don't remember the exact wording, but it was like a buy-in, you know, like, here's a taster. You want to try? We have a period of where you try yourself in the team. And then if we are not happy or you are not happy, we just part ways. And yeah.
Did you ever find out what the change of attitude was? Was it because I know people listening will be very interested in like, okay, so for people without experience or without, you know, years and years of experience, how did they get into the door, right? And obviously you did it, even though you were, like you said.
Yeah, I was underqualified for this role 100% or maybe even more. To be honest, there are some rumors, but there is no clear answer why they decided to hire me. Probably because the other guys were asking too much money. So that might be.
My guess is you probably behave well under pressure, right? I mean, I've gone through many, many interview loops myself. Yeah. And even if the person is, this is what Elon Musk said, right? You could always teach skills, but an attitude requires a brain transplant. So it's almost like, you know, I bet you probably, when they grill you, you may not know the answer, but you're logical in your reasoning. You're, you know, you have some poise under pressure. That's my guess, you know?
Yeah, it could be. They definitely asked me something and I said, yeah, I don't know it now, but I can master it in 2 days.
So let me add honesty into that qualification.
All right. Yeah, so that was it. And yeah, when I started, that's where networking technology really hit me. I mean, in a good way. So I started to work with very technical team. And because of that environment around me, I started to absorb a lot of networking background or networking skills. Mm-hmm. And then the job was really fun because we had to configure real devices in real customer networks.
Large service provider environment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like mobile networks providers that serve, you know, half the country, and you work to configure the services, and these services are not basic. So you configure service provider grade stuff. So it was really fun. I had to pass a lot of exams, like in Alcatel-Lucent, and now in Nokia, we had the same kind of CCNA, CCNP, CCIE, but in Nokia terms.
Sure.
Different names, but same story. So we had to go through that because we were technical people. We had to master all that stuff before we can really configure anything on the production networks.
Right.
So that was a rough, I would say, 2 years of core service provider engineering for me. I'm really grateful to go through that path. That was a very nice learning experience, and I wouldn't trade it for anything else. But then after that part, I got into software-defined networking. There was a startup inside Alcatel-Lucent, Nuage Networks. They did software-defined networking, and they were looking for people who are more on the automation kind of track.
Yeah.
And back then, I already started to do some network automation with Bash scripts or some Python, like very raw, unprofessional Python scripts. And yeah, they kind of saw that I like and love that automation part. And they said, okay, Roman, maybe you want to try and join us at Nuage. And that's how my more or less network automation story started to unroll.
Let's pause for a quick word from NetBox Labs. NetBox Labs helps you build and manage complex networks. NetBox Labs can help you drive your network automation initiatives. As a network source of truth, NetBox Labs provides a foundation for device provisioning, automated testing, monitoring updates, and more. The company's NetBox Cloud product offers an enterprise-grade SaaS version of open-source NetBox, the world's most popular network source of truth. As the commercial steward of NetBox, NetBox Labs actively invests in the community to grow a thriving NetBox ecosystem. NetBox Labs helps customers accelerate network automation by delivering open, composable products and supporting the network automation community. Check out their educational network management webinars or join a NetBox meetup. Find out more at netboxlabs.com/events. That's netboxlabs.com/events.
So what's your, and I'm only asking this for my personal curiosity, what's your definition for software-defined networking, right? Was it open flow, controller-based? Was it software-driven networking, like some of the Azure guys would say? What's your definition and what's your take on that?
It's definitely a lot of meanings to a lot of people.
Yep.
In our case, we had kind of twofold story. There was a software-defined networking, which is SD-WAN. That's where you have your drugstore network connected to your headquarters over raw internet, and then you have quality of service, and that's all driven through the centralized controller, and you program your CPEs without network engineering touching anything. So that was the thing that is SD-WAN.
Yeah.
And we also had the one in data center. That's where you automate your data centers, and that was SDDC. And that's totally different. That these are like two different domains, and we worked in both. So yeah, I think for the domain that you apply software-defined networking, it can mean, or it definitely worked differently.
And the only reason I ask is because, I mean, for a long time, I was a strong believer in open flow, open daylight, open everything.
But, yeah.
You know, and obviously the market has clearly demonstrated that that's not where it wants to go. So I was just kind of curious, especially in that time frame that you specify, that was where, you know, certainly a software defined is being slapped on a lot of like SD-WAN, right?
Yeah, we had this OpenFlow controller and the OpenFlow programmed switches, like the CPEs were programmed by OpenFlow.
Right.
And the story was nice. It really worked well, and it still worked in some enterprises. I think it just like didn't fly as high as everybody hoped.
Yeah.
And yes, nowadays you rarely hear SDN being mentioned. Right now, the tides change to cloud networking or network automation or intent-based networking. So yeah, it goes in spirals.
So much things I want to talk about, but let's just let it rest.
Yeah.
On software, like OpenFlow or anything like that.
Your
software-defined switch. But so how did you go from just being, you know, like, here's software-defined networking, you're a network engineer. How do you go from that into Container Lab? Was it some sort of problem that you were trying to solve?
From that part, when I was doing the software-defined networking in Nuage, I think 5 years passed, we released the Astro Linux network operating system.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. Yeah, tell us more about that, Astro Linux.
Yeah, I will tell the story about Container Lab, and that will also explain the Astro Linux part. So back in 2019, we at Nokia decided to enter the data center market. And when you enter the data center market, you have to have a few components in place. So one is, of course, the hardware for data center deployments. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be something off the shelf, right? So we went with Broadcom chips and Broadcom hardware. And because we already had a huge history of custom hardware, custom chipsets, we had no issues to producing our own hardware with Broadcom chipsets. So that part was done. What was not done is the network operating system. Because when you go to the data center, you either go with, let's say, something that's open and runs on white boxes.
Yes.
And you can go with Sonic and some other stuff. But we thought that we could create a network operating system that would be, I can go as brave as saying, better than the others. Mm-hmm. And because of the pedigree of the software engineering in networking domain specifically, we decided to build our own network operating system.
Mm.
And for better or for worse, the name that we intended to give to this NAS was not accepted by marketing because there was some clash with some Bitcoin company Bitcoin, but some other Ethereum company. So we had to roll with a plain Astro Linux name. And that's the name for our data center network operating system.
Yeah.
And we launched it in late 2019 internally. I think publicly it's 2020, early 2020s.
Mm-hmm.
When we released it, it was pure containerized network operating system for simulation and for virtual labbing.
Yeah.
Now, in 2019, it was already, you know, past DevOps wave. Everybody knows what container is, how to spin up a container. It's all kind of nice and dandy. But for software people or for enterprise people, a container is something that has only one interface, Ethernet 0, and that's it. And everything, you know, communicates through it.
Yeah.
What is changing in networking domain is that if your NAS is containerized, you rarely have just one interface. Your interface 0 is management, and you do not pass traffic through it. So what we used to have is a VM or a container with lots of interfaces. And through these interfaces, you build your topologies, be it Claw topology or, you know, like your WAN topology or something that represents your network. So how do you create a lab with containers with multiple interfaces?
Right.
Because like Docker only does ETH 0 and off you go. So how do you plug more?
Right.
And we started to look, and that was the problem, asking for a solution. How do you build a virtual networking lab topology with containers and create those links between them? And usually people use like a bash script, or they do manually patching the ETH pairs between containers, and then they say, yeah, here's your topology. Well, that definitely works, but it doesn't scale. You do not want to have your bash script that patches your VTH pairs between containers. You want to be more, you know, effective or efficient and have a tool that does that for you. And that's why we started to work on ContainLab. But the cool part is that we really didn't start ContainLab on our own. There was a project called Docker Topo created by I think Michael Cushing was the author of it. And he was back at Arista back then. And the Docker Topo was a Python project that they used internally for Arista CUS, containerized network operating system.
Right.
And Michael built this tool. Yeah, the tool was doing something close to what first versions of ContainerLab was doing. And when we saw it, we kind of thought, okay, the tool does what it advertises, but I think we can make it better. So we can improve the way it works, improve the installation, and make it really more like a product. Mm-hmm. And that's how ContainerLab ideas started to form and shape into a set of requirements. And that's when we started to work on the project, like you know, solidly.
Yeah, but even when there was already a project, but like you said, there's a lot of features that you need to add to it. Like there's some rough edges, right, before you could release it. So how long did it take between you have the idea into something that is you feel comfortable releasing it to even the beta users?
To be honest, it was pretty quick. So The story that not a lot of people know is that I did not start ContainerLab. There were two of my colleagues, Wim Hendricks and Karim Rodwani. They started to work on ContainerLab based on the first experiences with Docker Topo. And they started to put together the skeleton of what would be ContainerLab in the next years, right? Mm-hmm. And they started to do that like as a prototype. It was like a ContainerLab 001 version, for example. It was like really raw and really internally used between like ourselves, like three or four people.
Yeah.
But then once we realized that there is a potential, we started to clean it up and make it more consumable by others. So I would say it was probably like 2 or 3 months since the first commits towards the prototype that was working on somebody else's machine inside Nokia.
But how do you convince the higher ups? Because obviously, you know, it takes effort, it takes money, it takes man hours to really put the product together. How do you convince the upper ups to release this as a, you know, free tool for other people? Was it kind of the marketing angle? Or was it like customer adaptation for SR Linux? How did you do that?
To be honest, that would consume the whole hour to talk to tell you the story.
Or give us the 5-second story.
So the problem was that we started ContainerLab without asking permission. So we started it from the bottom-up approach. We decided we will build the tool. We will not tell anybody up high that we're working on it. And then we will make them take it because of the benefits that it gets. Right. So that was the unusual approach. I would say it was a brave one because we really thought that the ContainerLab that we had in our vision was something that would really blow the socks off from a lot of people.
Yeah.
But then, of course, asking to allocate man hours to it just by showing a slide deck and saying, you know, we will build this, this, and that, nobody would believe that. We thought, like, rather than trying and breaking this corporate walls, we will start under the radar, and then it's up to us if we can make it fly or not. And yeah, as history shows, we made it.
Yeah, so you didn't ask for permissions, right? You asked for forgiveness once you actually exactly. Proven out the acceptance. Yeah. And I mean, I was at Microsoft during the beginning of Sonic. You mentioned Sonic, and it certainly kind of followed the similar trajectory. And definitely was a grassroots, and it's not the Sonic today, right? Like, in fact, the people you see are representing Sonic today, making presentations, definitely were not the same folks who started it. But, you know, it is what it is, and I am happy that it worked out. And I think the whole community benefited from you guys' effort.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of wrap it up saying that there is a lot to say about how to start an open source project in a big corporation. And the bigger the company, the harder it is usually to start anything like that. There's so many walls and hoops you need to jump through and climb through. So that I would try to compile a slide deck and make a talk at one of the NOGs, maybe like a local NOG in the Netherlands or maybe an NNOG, summarizing my experience with that. And there were so many fun stories and scary ones during that, what it was like 4 years.
Yeah.
That it's really interesting. And what I wanted to say with that story is that do not afraid to start something like that. It's definitely scary. And sometimes you know, you break a few rules here and there, and some of them are really important and you shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, without that, the story would not be as successful as it is now. So yeah, being fearless is sometimes really nice. But yeah, you have to take the risk.
I would totally agree. I mean, besides Sonic, which is, you know, it is what it is today, it grew to the, you know, the size it is today. We were also doing, you know, it's also on Microsoft, like we did not ask for permissions to build what is essentially like a big switch, big tap product where we use SDN to, you know, kind of have more monitoring and visibility into the path and having a bigger control. And I would say out of my time on 5 years at Microsoft, those two were the highlights, right? Those were who I'm very proud of and point back and say, those were the highlights that innovation happened. Both of them, which were taking a lot of risk to breaking either relationships or breaking a few rules, but they were not detrimental, but they were definitely not, you know, like people raise eyebrows.
Yeah, no, it's definitely good to have a few projects like that that you can point back to and say, I think we did the right thing and it was not easy job to pull it, but yeah, we made it.
Yeah, totally. That's probably a good time to wrap up the first section of our talk. So where can people find you if they want to follow your work, follow Container Labs, Roman?
There are many venues you can tap in. So first one is containerlab.dev. That's the website for Container Lab with lots of information about it, how to download it, how to install it, how to use it.
Yeah.
And yeah, people can follow me on Twitter. I still refuse to call it X. So at NTDVPS. That's okay. NetDevOps without vowels. And then, yeah, of course, LinkedIn, Roman Dodin, I'm there as well. And yeah, that's it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, we'll have all those in the show notes and make sure you tune in to next week on the same topic. I know we barely touched the surface of Container Lab and we'll definitely talk more about it in the next section. Thank you for listening to Network Automation Nerds podcast today. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and all the other major podcast platforms. Until next time, bye-bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of Network Automation Nerds. Do you have any feedbacks for Network Automation or this episode? Send me some follow-ups at packetpushers.net/FU. I want to hear from you. Check out our website at packetpushers.net to find other network engineering-focused podcasts, blogs, YouTube videos, and the Slack channel. Last but not least, remember that too much network automation would never be enough.